are the truth.
What are your guiltiest secrets?
I mean, I don't personally have any, of course. Honestly, I'm a completely guilt-free area.
I'm Stephen Mangan, and in The Confessional on Radio 4, I'll be taking a bevy of illustrious sinners through a dark journey through the realm of shame, sin, and toe-curling embarrassment. They'll be stepping into my virtual confession box. Sorry, can we get some more light in here? To reveal three shameful revelations about themselves.
Oh, that's disgusting.
The Confessional, the show in which celebrity guests dig the dirt on themselves. Sunday evenings at 7:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now on Radio 4, we join John Lloyd and his brand new curator, Holly Walsh, for a new series of...
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, a kind of bounty castle for the mind, but much, much larger and you don't have to take your shoes off. Now, we're unveiling a new gallery this week and with it a brand new curator. Please welcome writer, art historian and badger expert Holly Walsh.
Hello, John.
Hello, Holly. And how are things going on your first day?
Yeah, pretty good, thank you, Professor. Although good. This place is clearly a health and safety nightmare.
Well, it's not too bad, as long as you remember to avoid the bears, the wolves, the parasitic wasps and Mad Jack Churchill. Have you seen anything you takes your fancy?
I am completely besotted with the single shreddy. Somebody donated a single beautiful shreddy.
Yes, Rory Sutherland, that was amazing. He's a brilliant marketing man, and shreddies weren't selling very well, so he turned it through 90 degrees and marketed them as new diamond shreddies. And they just flew off the shelves. Brilliant idea.
That just goes to show how stupid people are first thing in the morning.
Okay, wonderful. Now allow me to introduce today's steering committee. Caledonian comedian Jamie MacDonald, Antipodean art expert Jennifer Higgy, and Oxonian originator of fine paintings, Francis Hamill.
Hello. Hello.
Since everybody's from all over the place, Jamie, what's your favourite thing about Glasgow?
I like how we are the friendliest, most kind of welcoming folk on the planet, and people who don't agree with that are in big trouble.
Francis, what's your favourite outdoor spot in Oxfordshire?
We rent a little house on an estate in Oxfordshire, which is next to these extraordinary gardens. And since Boris told us we couldn't leave home, I think they've become my favourite place. And so I've been painting it and drawing it and swimming in it and eating in it and obsessing about it for most of the last couple of years.
Jennifer, what's your top tourist tip for Australia?
You know, I think if you really wanted to get a good sort of view of the overall country, you could do no better than visiting Australia's big things. You could go to the big koala, the big merino, the big galahs, big thumbs up. And there's even a big spider, which is nicknamed the not so itsy. So I think that would give you a pretty good impression of the country.
Jamie, you're a comedian, actor and writer. Mm. You wrote and starred in your Radio 4 series Life on the Blink and have also appeared on Breaking the News, Scott Squad and BBC Radio Scotland's The Afternoon Show, where you co-host a monthly audiobook club. You recently made the documentary Blind Ambition for BBC Two, where you went in search of the country's most creative people who happen to be blind. And who impressed you the most?
Apart from myself, I would have to say, no, we met some great people on that trip. There was an opera singer and there was a rapper where I felt every one of my 41-year-old Scottish middle-class self. But I think the guy that really kind of shone through, we met a wood turner, and this guy was totally blind, and he hadn't been a wood turner before, and he made some really, really nice stuff. And just before he gave us a go on the lathe, which I was kind of against because I was that blind leading the blind adage was running through my head, and that never ends well. But he was talking about degloving a finger. And that's where the thing just sooks the skin right off your finger. And he's like, now, see if you can shape this chair leg. But yeah, he was very impressive. But they were all great. As I said, I said about it, it was like the show was more about triumph with adversity rather than over it. That's kind of my thing.
I love that line, Jamie. That's such a great way of putting it. There was a thing about a poll in the New York Times that I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, cheeky swines out in the New York Times. They did a poll on, like, the worst thing that could ever happen to you, and it's to go blind. That got number one. And A, I don't think that's the case, and B, blind people can't read the New York Times, so we couldn't get to vote. So it's an absolute rigged vote anyway. So, I would encourage those people who voted in that daft poll to watch Blind Ambition, because it's we don't just wake up in the morning and go, God, I wish I could say my life is awful. We just crack on and we do quite nice things.
But I'm talking of getting on with it. I read Aberdeen's only blind boxer.
Well, that was an accident. That was Aberdeen Uni. And I liked fitness, and I knew that boxing was very good fitness. So I kind of went along just to do the training. But the coach, I think he'd just seen Star Wars, because he thought I had, like, the Force. And I could sense punches. And he put me in the ring, this psycho. And I was, you know, I was saying to this guy that I was about to fight, don't go easy on me just because I can't see. And he didn't. He leathered me, you know. And I was kind of like, well, go easy on me, but pretend you're not, you know.
You've got a programme coming up called Blindsided, which is about a stand-up comedian who moves from Glasgow to Sheffield just before a pandemic hits. Is that based on some kind of true story?
Absolute fantasy. Yes, we moved down. My wife is a surgeon, and a paediatric one, and she got the consultancy in Sheffield last April. We moved down to Sheffield, where I knew nobody and I had no work, and I was trying to kind of reestablish, you know, like, where I was on the planet, going to shops. It was this time where if you went off the one-way system in Tesco's, it was like a killer was on the loose. And I wrote a kind of day in the life of a blind man moving to a new city during a plague.
Well, thank you, Jamie. It's great that you can join us, or to use the standard greeting of your adopted city of Sheffield, Ayop lad. Coming to you now, Jennifer, you're a writer and art expert, and were an editor at contemporary art magazine Frieze for over 20 years. You've judged the Turner Prize, curated the Haywood Touring and Arts Council Collection exhibition One Day Something Happens, Pictures of People, and recently published The Mirror and the Palette, 500 Years of Women's Self-Portraits. Do you remember when you first became interested in art?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really remember not being interested in art. I mean, and when you're a child, of course, you love painting pictures and looking at pictures. But I do remember when I was very little, probably in kindergarten, and my teacher, who was called Mrs. Colgate, I always remember her name because of the toothpaste, and she did an amazing painting of a lyrebird. And she said all of the lines of the painting have to go in the same direction for it to be a good picture. And she was totally wrong. but I do remember thinking that was, oh, that's how you make a good picture. And so I do remember that as a very specific moment of, like, that's really interesting. That's how you paint a lyrebird.
But you were a bit rubbish at art at school, I understand.
Well, I must say, I wasn't very good at it in year 12, and I did actually get an E, and I think it was the only time I ever got an E in my life. But the art teacher and I didn't really see eye to eye on things, and I think I was also a bit naughty, and I thought she was a bit dull the way she was teaching art, so I was a bit bad.
I just want to cheer you up with some of these school reports from famous people. Charlotte Bronte's school report said she writes indifferently and knows nothing of grammar. John Lennon's school report said, hopeless, rather a clown in class. He's just wasting other people's time, certainly on the road to failure.
You know Wetherspoons? Tim Martin from Wetherspoons named Wetherspoons after a teacher who told him he'd amount to nothing.
Oh, that's a
revenge.
Jennifer, as well as the Turner Prize, you've also judged the John Moores Painting Prize, the Paul Hamlin Award, and the 2021 Freeland Painting Prize. Where do you begin with judging art? How does that work?
Well, I think that, of course, it is a personal thing because, you know, you bring your own tastes and interests to art always. But
as long as all the lines are pointing one way.
I mean, all going one way. That's
it always goes
been
back to that lyrebird, yeah. The first painting you were ever impressed by.
Exactly. Yeah, as long as they're going the same way.
I can only look like a barcode.
You know, as with anything, I mean, people often say, oh, God, how do you judge contemporary art when it seems that anything goes? But, you know, even if you've got, you know, an artist just turning the lights on and off, they're doing something interesting in a space that maybe hadn't been done before. They're doing something fresh and original with materials. They're saying something vital about the present moment. Does the artwork stop you in your tracks? Or most importantly, can it only be expressed in its current form? You know, so I think that there's nothing worse than an artwork that, you know, needs reams of paper to describe exactly what's going on and why it's important. You know, so I think all of the, in the same way that you judge a 19th or 18th century painting, you can judge art made in the contemporary moment.
Have you come across this Italian sculptor who, Maurizio Savini, who makes sculptures from chewing gum? You probably wouldn't want to touch those particularly.
I've picked one of his up in my shoe.
Finally, Jennifer, you're currently working on a new book about women artists and the spirit world. How spooky are things getting there?
I'm deeply immersed in spirits, yeah. Its working title is The Other Side, Women, Art and the Spirit World. And so I'm looking at 19th century women. A lot of 19th century women were interested in spiritualism and would have seances and then use themselves as a sort of conduit for a spirit to make paintings. And in a way, the least interesting question for me is whether there really were spirits or not. It's more that it was a community of women making these paintings, and a lot of them are absolutely amazing. So it's a really fascinating area, I think.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. It might not have been a grade you achieved in your final year at school, but in our eyes, you are most certainly a star. And over to you, Francis. You're an internationally renowned painter, best known for landscapes and portraiture. You've toured with Gifford Circus, created work for Fortnum & Mason, and painted a mural for the Victoria Palace Theatre as part of its recent renovations. What's your favourite subject to paint?
I paint loads of different things. So I suppose I'm more interested in ways of looking at things than I am in subjects. So I tend to kind of move around quite a lot. But the one thing I paint all the time without fail is trees. I've always got a kind of tree on the go because, unlike portrait subjects, they sit still and cooperate and don't look at their watch at 12:30 and say, maybe it's time for lunch.
Do you have a favourite tree?
I've got a few favourite trees. They're kind of types of trees. I like cedar trees and oak trees. I mean, where we live, there's a sort of park outside the window, and I've got some old friends in there that I paint relentlessly.
Do you ever, when you're painting portraits of people or even actually doing a mural in someone's room, do you say to them, this, what you get is what you get? Or are you a people pleaser and feel like you feel like, you know, you have to try and flatter them? Or
yeah.
Do you feel like it's your duty to make something they want? Or are you like, you're lucky to have me and this is what we're doing?
I got rung up by a woman I was painting once who said the diamond in my engagement ring isn't big enough.
I think there's something about your work that I think is unusual. And I've got a friend who's a very good photographer who has the same effect, which is your paintings make people feel better.
God, that's an incredibly nice thing to say. I mean, I hope that there's... I love the thought of that being the case. They are, in some sense, meant to be a form of escape, a kind of window into a world where at least there's some beauty.
When I interviewed you when you published your book to say, do you find painting difficult? To which you said, yes, which surprised me because I've watched you work and it looks like you look like you're dancing. These things just emerge like a developing photograph. But is one thing more difficult to paint than another? Is a tree harder than a face, for example?
I think different subjects present different problems. I mean, a tree is great because it sits still and, you know, I mean, obviously it changes and it moves a bit, but it's basically cooperating. But the thing that interests me about the work I try to do is just the private battles that happen in the studio where I'm just struggling to make things as good as I want them. And paint sometimes cooperates. Maybe when you saw me working, the paint was on my side. But a lot of the time, it just doesn't do what you want it to do. And so there's a sort of battleground.
Do you give up on paintings or do you always finish them?
No, I give up. I throw a lot away. I paint over a lot. Sometimes I just scrape all the paint off, turn it upside down and start all over again.
Sometimes I feel sorry for painters who, you know, they go, and we found this painting underneath, because they're probably like, yeah, that was never meant to be seen because it was a pile of rubbish.
Layer upon layer upon layer.
You've scraped off a much better painting to reveal a really bad painting underneath.
Your most recent exhibition, Frank, Rousham Through the Gardens, is about to open at London's John Martin Gallery. So that's kind of a lifetime getting to know that garden, really. How long did the actual exhibition take you to paint?
Rousham, we've lived at for 25 years, and I've painted it on and off during that time. But when we were locked down at the beginning of 2020, it took me kind of 30 seconds to realize that, you know, it was time to really concentrate on painting the place. And I started by drawing it for a month and mapping it, drawing the paths and the incidental bits between the kind of main events. And it was quite nice to start off quite slowly and just build up. And I became kind of obsessed with it in the end.
That's a lot of work. Well, thank you, Frank. Your paintings are delightful and remarkable, not only for your skill, but also as the only items in Fortnum's which are more valuable than their Christmas hampers.
Thank you, John.
Now, Holly, as curator, it's your solemn duty to open the museum for donations.
Oh, that is brilliant. Can I just ask, though, is there some sort of special ceremony?
Yes, indeed. As dictated by the museum's articles, you must now decipher and intone aloud the runic cuneiform written on this ancient sound effect.
Right. I now declare the museum open for donations.
And now you must play this trumpet. Brilliant.
God, I thought my embouchure had let go, but that was pretty stunning.
You still got it. You still got it.
Still got the lips. I was actually in a brass band for 5 years.
Really?
And I played
the
trumpet.
As a trumpeter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jamie, what would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to donate a blue badge to the museum, please.
Tell me more. What is this blue badge?
Well, the blue badge is the kind of symbol of what I think is a very accessible society. So I mean, many disabled people might disagree with me, but I think it's an excellent time to be disabled. I mean, if you do get the chance, but it's I think since 1995, this thing, the Disabilities Act, came in, which gave us the phrase reasonably adjustable. And the blue badge typifies this because it was a brilliant time. Everybody had to kind of reasonably adjust everything so we could kind of start using stuff. You know, councils and businesses had to reasonably adjust their properties so we could finally come in. And, you know, we obliterated... You know, first thing we did was we obliterated spiral staircases. You know, they'd been nailing us for centuries. And I think it's a symbol of a nice, caring society, which is maybe a wee bit contrary to the current kind of vibes at the moment. But I think it's a nice place to live, and the blue badge typifies that.
Am I right in thinking that there isn't just one blue badge, that there's numerous different disability badges that different areas of the country have?
That you can collect them like the Scouts. I've got my disabled in Wales badge. I think it's just across the board. I think it's this one blue badge in the windscreen, and you can park pretty much where you like.
Have you heard this, that there's a black market in blue badges? Apparently people smash car windows to pinch them. Has that happened?
I mean, it's a very extreme action to get close to Tesco. I think you've got to have a look at yourself if you're smashing a car to take a blue badge off of somebody. It's funny the accessibility thing, though. It's gone a little bit too comfortable, and some people are starting to kind of realise that possibly we're at it, because I was getting assistance through an airport. It was Glasgow Airport. It was pre-pandemic, and one of the great things is I just get wafted past large queues, you know. And it was the one going into passport control, but it was one of the big long ones, and I was being paraded past it, and I was hearing all the guys kind of go, "What's he getting past this queue for?" You know, he's disabled, you know, but is he disabled enough, you know, to be skipping such a horrible, horrible queue? And one woman I think she cried. She must have been in the queue for hours because she shouted at me and this like assistant, "How does he get to skip the queue?" And the assistant, "Well, because he's blind." And she went, "No joke." She went, "Aye, but that doesn't make him rubbish at queuing, does it?"
Finally, Jamie, what do you think would be the best way to display the blue badge in our museum? Should it have its own space just outside the front door?
Well, no, I think it should be just inside the front window, displayed so you can park your museum anywhere.
That's brilliant.
Like in front of the Louvre.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Front of, yeah, just dwarfing. Yeah, yeah. You know, the Louvre's looking pretty busy. And the Curiosity, look, it's over there.
Well, Jamie, we'll make sure that that blue badge is very clearly displayed in the front window of the museum, not only for the benefit of our visitors, but in case there are any traffic wardens in the area.
So, Jenny, you're next. What exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
Well, I would like to donate a very special painting from 1548, and it's a self-portrait by a young woman called Catharina van Hemmersen. And it was made in Antwerp. And what's really extraordinary about this painting is it's a really small little painting. You might not notice it even if you're wandering through a gallery. It's quite modest. It depicts a young woman painting herself at the easel. And it's written in the painting, "I, Catharina van Hemmersen, painted this when I was 20. But what is really remarkable about this painting is that it's the first self-portrait by anyone of an artist seated at an easel. And so it just boggles my mind to think of this young woman in 1548 thinking, all right, I'm going to do a selfie of myself working at a time when it's so hard for a woman to be an artist at that time because you're barred from academies and apprenticeships and all the rest of it. So I would like to donate that absolutely revolutionary little painting to the museum.
How did artists portray themselves before she had the idea of being at the easel?
Well, the idea of self-portraiture was very rare at that point. I mean, a few people had done it. Titian had done a great self-portrait. Durer, of course, did these great self-portraits around 1500. But the men tended to depict themselves as quite Christ-like. And there wasn't a great tradition at all of female self-portraiture. There was one nun in the Middle Ages who showed herself, who depicted herself swinging off a letter, which is pretty wonderful in an illuminated manuscript. But it was rare. It's sort of mind-boggling that when we think now how often people take selfies every day and it takes 1 second on your phone. But the idea that this young woman sat down and thought, I'm going to depict myself working. To my mind, even though it looks like a very sort of modest little image, I think it's a sort of a bit of a battle cry. She's saying, I might be a woman, I might not have any political agency, but look at me, I can be an artist. And so I think it's a really bold statement, actually, and I love it.
This sounds like a very valuable exhibit, but do we need to have some creative way to protect it? Because obviously the Mona Lisa, someone poured acid onto it. It now is behind bulletproof glass. And some galleries put marbles behind their paintings. It's a low-cost way of doing security, so that if somebody tries to nick it, then thousands of marbles pour down, and then you know it's going to get stolen.
It would really humorously trip up the burglars as well, wouldn't it, as they try to run over the marbles?
Yeah.
If you put the Elgin marbles behind the painting, it'd stick out too far from the wall, wouldn't they? That would be not good.
I was trying to think about what should be protecting this very rare and very early painting. And wouldn't it be great if you could get some of the goddess Athena's nymphs to surround it? Because they're really, really tough. They can transform robbers into like stags. So I think it would be very safe with some of the goddess Athena's nymphs.
I think you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, they are very, very expensive. I happen to know that they do a lot of work for Cartier and, you know, some of the higher brand Bond Street, that kind of new, you know, area. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that actually the employment rate among nymphs at the moment because of the pandemic is a little difficult. So I think we probably get a few cut price ones.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for bringing this unique self-portrait to our attention. Clearly, social media took a lot more effort in the 16th century.
So, last but not least, Francis, what would you like to give the museum?
I'd like to donate Hieronymus Bosch's painting called The Garden of Earthly Delights. I've probably set myself a fairly challenging task trying to describe this picture because it's unlike the Catharina van Hemmersen painting. It's quite big. It's about 6 feet high and about twice that size in width. So it's a great big picture. And it's absolutely packed full of people, all of them except one naked. And the three, it's a triptych. It's in three panels. The left-hand panel, the two left-hand panels are quite gardeny. They're green. There are lakes and ponds around. And then the left-hand panel has God introducing Adam and Eve. We now move on to the central panel, which has got, must have 200 figures in it. It's got all of them naked. It's a massive parade of sort of sexual activity, a sort of pageant of slightly bored-looking figures. There's not a kind of huge amount of facial animation. And then the third panel is in strong contrast because the sort of sun is slightly out in those two panels. It's green and blue and sort of rather kind of, well, gardeny. The right-hand panel is hell. In this panel is this bizarre figure called the Tree Man in the middle, which is a sort of hollowed-out torso supported by two arms that are really kind of bleached tree trunks held up or supported in two little black yachts. And the figure kind of looks back out of the picture. It's as well as being a torso and arms, it's a head looking kind of slightly complacent and slightly ironic over his shoulder. And then there's a ladder going up to the hollowed out torso with a figure who's had an arrow stuck up his backside. And he's on his way up the ladder to this little hollowed out area inside, which is kind of a pub. It's full of jolly people kind of having a drink.
It is probably nicer than some Wetherspoons, to be fair. So,
but Frank, this is the title. Do you think the title of the painting's ironic? Because it's pretty gross, isn't it, a lot of it?
The odd thing about it is that it's kind of grotesque and bizarre, but it's not. It feels so distant and so remote that I don't find it horrifying. I think it's good for the Museum of Curiosity because it arouses immense curiosity, because it's so cryptic. It's completely jammed full of symbolism and things that probably meant something to Hieronymus Bosch, but that are impossible to decode, or at least lots and lots of people have tried to decode it. And nobody can agree really what the picture's about. And I think one of the lovely things about it is that it is kind of a mystery. The gardens which I've been painting, people come along with elaborate ideas about how the garden was laid out and what the garden means and what the statues are referring to. And in a way, I understand why people enjoy that and have the need to do that. But in a way, it's just lovely to enjoy just to savour the mystery. To savour the feeling of curiosity.
I like this story that in 2014, it says here, a blogger named Amelia was looking at the painting and she noticed a peculiar detail, a series of musical notes tattooed on the bum of one of Bosch's tortured sinners. So she zoomed in on them, transcribed them into modern notation, recorded a piano version of what she called the 600-year-old butt song from hell. Well, Frank, thank you so much for donating this magnificent triptych to us. I happen to own a Bosch myself, oddly.
Do you?
Yes, it's 84 by 58 centimetres and washes dishes. It's really lovely. So there we have it. The museum's collection now includes a blue badge, a 16th century selfie and a Hieronymus Heaven and Hell. We've been educated, entertained and most importantly of all, we now have free parking. I'd like to thank Jamie, Jennifer and Francis, and I leave you with this from Vincent van Gogh. The great doesn't happen through impulse alone and is a succession of little things that are brought together, though he did also say one must spoil as many canvases as one succeeds with. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Holly Walsh. The donors were Francis Hummel, Jennifer Hickey and Jamie McDonald. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Shepherd, Mike Turner and Jack Chambers and Emily Jupitus of QI. The producer was Anne Miller and it was a BBC Studios production.
Other dishwashers are available, including Frigidaire, GE, IKEA, Samsung, Maytag and Whirlpool. The value of your investments may go down as well as up. Terms and conditions apply.
Always check the terms and conditions. And